Welcome to the debate. When jurisdictions pass, you know, these sweeping anti-money laundering laws, there's usually this momentary sense of triumph.
Oh, absolutely. The ink dries on the legal framework and supervisors just congratulate themselves on a job well done.
Right, exactly. But the real challenge begins the morning after, when those theoretical blueprints clash with the brutal reality of enforcement. I mean, look at East Africa. Following that June 19, 2026 FATF statement, the one retaining Kenya and South Sudan under increased monitoring, the regulatory framework there has grown incredibly dense.
Yeah, it really has. But passing laws is no longer the hurdle.
Exactly. The only thing that matters now is execution.
Well, the laws are on the books, sure, but the execution gap remains massive. I mean, we are looking at a region where the volume of financial transactions is just exploding.
Right.
But the actual conversion of those transactions into, you know, disruptive intelligence, it is lagging dangerously behind.
Which brings us to the central question we are debating today. In this high-stakes execution phase, which reporting entities are actually most vital for generating actionable financial intelligence?
It's the core issue.
I take the position that financial institutions, so banks, mobile network operators, payment service providers, they hold the key due to their unparalleled macro-level visibility into payment corridors and flow behavior.
And I take the opposing view. I argue that designated non-financial businesses and professions, the DNFBPs, which includes, you know, your lawyers, accountants, real estate professionals, they are the true linchpin. They possess the essential micro-level contextual data regarding ownership and commercial purpose.
All right, let me explain why the execution of AML and CFT policy fundamentally relies on the architecture of financial institutions. If you look at modern financial risks, particularly virtual asset exposure, they've mutated.
Mutated how?
Well, they're no longer isolated to niche dark web platforms. Illicit finance is now just an ordinary payments problem.
I'll agree with that much.
Right. And in East Africa, we have a very fragmented regulatory timeline across Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, and Tanzania. And because of this fragmentation, financial risk behaves like water. It naturally and rapidly migrates to the lowest friction corridor.
Sure, they shift.
If one jurisdiction tightens its mobile money caps, illicit actors immediately shift to another payment route that presents less resistance.
They shift, yeah, but the destination remains the exact same.
Yes, but only financial institutions have the systemic cross-border scale to actually detect that shift in real time. I am talking about the mechanical flow behavior here.
But volume doesn't equal intelligence.
Let me finish. A bank's automated systems can flag rapid consolidation. Say 50 retail accounts suddenly funnel micro deposits into a single corporate account, which then immediately wires the funds to a crypto exchange.
Okay, yes, they see that.
Banks see the fiat on-ramps and off-ramps. They see illicit activity trying to mask itself within the millions of legitimate transactions crossing ordinary payment rails every single day. Without the macro-level net that FIs cast, you are operating completely blind.
You aren't operating blind, you are operating with precision rather than volume. Look, the execution gap in East Africa cannot be closed by transactional scale alone.
But you need the scale to see the pattern.
No, you need an intelligence yield that only DNFBPs can provide. Financial institutions consistently fall into a very predictable systemic trap, defensive filing.
Oh, calling it a trap is a bit of a stretch.
It is a trap. When regulators apply pressure, banks dramatically increase their suspicious transaction report, or STR, submission counts. They just tweak their algorithms to flag every minor anomaly to satisfy the supervisors.
They're following the law.
But they do it without actually improving the analytical conversion of those reports.
Filing an STR based on algorithmic triggers isn't a trap. It is the required first line of defense.
It becomes a trap when a million bank STRs flood the financial intelligence unit and are effectively useless. They lack the ownership resolution and commercial contradiction data that DNFBPs hold.
I mean, useless is a strong word.
Knowing how a unit of value moved mechanically across a border is entirely meaningless if you do not know the natural person who actually controls the asset. FIs track the vehicle. DNFBPs know who is holding the steering wheel.
All right, let's look at how this exposure actually presents itself today, specifically regarding indirect virtual asset or VASP exposure.
Let's do that.
Illicit actors don't just, you know, walk into a bank branch and announce they're moving stablecoins. They don't register their corporate entities as crypto brokers.
Obviously not.
Right. The exposure is indirect. It is routed through personal bank accounts, mobile money collections, informal peer-to-peer trading networks. FIs are the only entities capable of mapping the minimum data view required to detect this.
But what does that minimum data view actually give you? A list of IP addresses? Come on.
It gives you the digital fingerprint of the entire shadow network. FIIs are mapping device links, VPN usage, repeated counterparties, rapid cross-border pass-throughs.
A fingerprint isn't a name, though.
But if someone is running a peer-to-peer crypto desk using a personal mobile money account, how do you catch them? You look at the channel and the device.
Which tells you nothing about intent.
When you see a retail collection account where hundreds of incoming payments from totally unrelated individuals are consolidated and then transferred to a common beneficiary within minutes, bypassing normal clearing delays, that is a pattern only visible on the banking side.
Yes, they see the pattern.
FIIs catch value moving outside the visible banking chain because they monitor the exact entry and exit points where cash or mobile money converts into virtual assets.
I agree that financial institutions see the movement. Absolutely. But this is merely measuring activity, not effect.
Activity is the crime.
Tracking a mobile money collection or a shared device ID is fundamentally hollow. If you cannot match that digital subject to a real human being without months of manual reconstruction by law enforcement, what is the point?
The point is that it points directly to the illicit flow of funds. Without the FI flagging the IP address and the transaction velocity, you don't even know a crime is occurring.
But you are tracking a ghost. You see the footprint in the digital snow, but you have no earthly idea who the person actually is. Let's look at the draft VASP regulations in Kenya.
Okay, the draft regs, sure.
They signal a positive direction of travel. But during this current transition period, looking purely at payment routes gives regulators a dangerous false sense of security.
How is it false security to catch the funds?
Because if a bank flags a rapid consolidation of funds and files an STR based on device links, what actually happens next?
The FIU gets it.
Right. The Financial Intelligence Unit receives a massive spreadsheet full of IP addresses and transaction velocities. It completely lacks the critical component. Who is the natural person benefiting?
The FIU uses that data to start the investigation. That's how it works.
An investigation that stalls instantly without DNFBP input, without the trusting company service provider who legally incorporated the shell company and knows the ultimate beneficial owner.
If they even kept accurate records.
Or the real estate agent who knows why that consolidated money is supposedly being used to buy a high-end property in Nairobi. Without them, that bank data just sits in a database. It is unactionable noise.
Okay, look, relying purely on DNFPPs to map illicit finance is like trying to map a river's current by examining individual rocks.
Rocks give you context.
Yes, the rocks give you incredibly detailed context about one specific point in the riverbed. I'll give you that. But financial institutions and payment processors are the only ones who can actually see the flow of the water.
The flow doesn't tell you the source.
They see the volume, the speed, the origin, and the destination. A lawyer or an accountant might see one isolated transaction for a property purchase and think, hey, this looks perfectly legitimate.
Because to them, it might be.
Exactly. But the bank, however, sees the 10,000 micro deposits from four different high-risk jurisdictions that funded the account used for that purchase.
But mapping the river doesn't matter if you're drowning the investigators in useless data. That is the ultimate fallacy of relying so heavily on the FI-centric approach.
They aren't drowning them.
They confuse raw STR volume with actionable intelligence. Grayless remediation, exactly what Kenya and South Sudan are undergoing right now, triggers a very specific, deeply flawed reaction from the banking sector.
I really wouldn't call it a flawed reaction. The surge in suspicious transaction reports is a direct response to tighter supervisory standards. Banks are doing what the law requires them to do.
They are overcorrecting to protect themselves. It's defensive filing. The banks are terrified of massive regulatory fines, so they lower the thresholds on their transaction monitoring systems.
That's called being compliant.
Suddenly, their algorithms flag every single borderline transaction. A customer transfers slightly more money than usual. Flagged.
an IP address pings from a neighboring country, flagged.
Better safe than sorry.
They take their institutional uncertainty and just dump it onto the desk of the Financial Intelligence Unit. It is an administratively simple response, but an analytically weak one.
I disagree.
Submission counts go up, giving the illusion of compliance, but the downstream utility, dissemination to law enforcement, actual investigative uptake, asset recovery, it remains completely flat.
Defensive filing is just a recognized frictional cost of a tightening regime, but it doesn't negate the foundational necessity of FI data.
It dilutes it entirely.
You can tune an algorithm to reduce false positives. You cannot tune a real estate agent to suddenly understand complex cross-border flow typologies.
It severely dilutes the intelligence. Furthermore, defensive filing is often accompanied by the banking sector's terrible tendency toward broad de-risking.
De-risking is a legitimate risk management tool.
Instead of conducting actual, nuanced customer-level analysis, banks just shut down entire corridors or product lines because it's cheaper than compliance.
Well, if the risk is too high...
What happens when a bank de-risks a remittance corridor between Kenya and Somalia? The underlying economic activity doesn't stop.
No, it shifts.
It moves into hawala brokers, informal cash couriers, completely opaque payment routes. Broad de-risking pushes the risk entirely out of the light.
That's a regulatory failure, not just an FI failure.
True utility requires assessing data sufficiency. Names, identification numbers, verifiable ownership links. That legal authority and source of funds documentation is overwhelmingly sitting in the filing cabinets of DNFPBs, not banks.
Okay, but the reality of AML and CFT execution is that it requires immediate machine-scale responses. DNFBPs fundamentally lack the architecture to execute at that level.
They don't need machine scale if they have the context.
Let's look at targeted financial sanctions, which is the absolute bedrock of the FATF operating chain. Look at what happened on July 8, 2026.
The UN update?
Yes. When the UN updated the ISIL and Al-Qaeda sanctions list, they specifically added new aliases to known operatives. When a new alias drops, how is that actually enforced across an entire economy?
Well, the reporting entities are required to screen their clients.
Yes, but how? A real estate agent or a casino operator isn't going to catch a sophisticated alias. They are checking a static list maybe once a year, if that.
That's an enforcement issue.
A bank's algorithm, however, immediately cross-references millions of records. FIs execute complex field mapping and machine speed transliteration testing,
which generates tons of false positives.
They test for phonetic spelling variations of that new alias in Arabic, English, and Swahili across every single transaction in their system in milliseconds.
Again, machine scale.
They utilize fuzzy matching to catch a sanctioned individual who swapped two letters in their surname just to bypass basic filters. Financial institutions provide the infrastructural defense.
Okay, but
FIs are the only entities capable of applying an updated sanctions regime across millions of nodes instantaneously.
Look, I don't dispute the technical capacity of banks to run transliteration algorithms. They are very good at catching the names we already know,
which is critical.
But let's look at what we are actually trying to dismantle here. Let's move from the mechanics of sanctions screening to the ultimate threat in this region, terrorist financing. Specifically, Al-Shabaab-related networks operating across Kenya, Ethiopia, Djibouti, Uganda, and Tanzania.
Those networks rely heavily on moving capital, which puts them squarely in the crosshairs of FI transaction monitoring.
Algorithms are great for straightforward wire transfers labeled militia funding, but that is not how Al-Shabaab operates.
Obviously not literally labeled that way.
Analyzing that specific threat requires following the commercial network, not the payment product. This completely validates the DNFBP perspective. The risk is hidden in logistics.
It still flows through banks.
It is embedded in the livestock trade, in agricultural levies, in fuel distribution, and telecommunication services.
But remittances are a heavily documented and well-known channel for moving those funds. FIs and PSPs monitor those corridors aggressively.
Remittances are relevant, sure. But in East Africa, legitimate remittance activity is so massive that trying to find a terrorist financer in those flows is mathematically impossible.
It's difficult, not impossible.
The sheer volume of normal diaspora money generates an impossible number of false positives. A single sender transferring funds rapidly doesn't mean anything in isolation. To spot the actual threat, you need commercial contradiction data.
But commercial contradiction is entirely subjective, isn't it?
Not if you're a professional in that sector.
How does a local accountant or a lawyer drafting a contract actually know what a logistics company's supply chain is supposed to look like across the Ethiopian border?
You are expecting them to act as professionals who understand basic commercial reality. Commercial contradiction as activity that is wildly inconsistent with the stated business, the physical trade route, or the procurement need.
Give me an example.
If a logistics company is booking revenue that doesn't match the physical reality of regional transport routes, say their fuel expenditures are a fraction of what they should be for the routes they claim to be running, who sees that first?
The auditor, maybe?
The accountant auditing their books. If a small agricultural business is suddenly procuring industrial chemicals or electronics that make no sense for crop management, who sees it?
The lawyer.
The lawyer drafting the procurement contracts, DNFBPs, observe the operational financing of the network. If you just follow the payment product, you miss the extortion, the taxation, and the physical supply chain realities.
I completely disagree with that premise because you are skipping the first necessary step of detection.
Which is?
I acknowledge the importance of commercial context, but what you are describing relies on indicator stacking. You cannot identify a commercial contradiction if you do not first see the money pooling and moving.
They can see the contracts without the bank.
That stack invariably begins with the financial institutions.
How? If the business front looks perfectly legitimate on paper and the transaction amounts match their stated revenue, the bank's algorithm won't flag a thing.
Because the bank sees the aggregate transactional behavior that breaks the pattern. Take South Sudan's specific jurisdictional weaknesses.
Okay, highly exposed.
Their execution gap is characterized by severe capacity constraints and incredibly high exposure to politically exposed persons, or PEPs, utilizing complex procurement networks.
Right.
If you want to find illicit oil sector intermediaries or corrupt NGO contractors siphoning funds out of Juba, you cannot just wait for a local accountant to notice a discrepancy in a ledger.
You kind of have to.
No, you have to first detect the splitting of payments, the unusual cash conversions, and the rapid cross-border passers.
But without the network data, the common controllers, the shared directors, the beneficial ownership layers, that transactional behavior is just noise. It just looks like standard corporate settlement.
And who maps the repeated beneficiaries and shared digital identifiers across those corporate accounts? The banks. That is FI data.
Only the digital identifiers.
A corrupt NGO doesn't just send money directly to a PEP's personal account. They layer it. The bank spots the circular flow. The bank spots the unexplained, rapid cross-border settlement between an NGO operational account in Juba and an obscure real estate holding company in Nairobi.
But the DNFBP holds the keys to the property.
The DNFBP, the lawyer, might hold the deed to the property, but they only see one side of the transaction. The FI maps the entire financial supply chain that purchased it.
The FI doesn't know who owns the holding company.
You cannot detect South Sudan's exposure to regional property laundering without first identifying the macro-level cross-border payment corridors being exploited. A true risk-based approach requires distinguishing broad jurisdictional weakness from the specific risk presented by a customer, and FIs alone have the systemic data to make that distinction.
You know, despite the friction here, I think we are actually circling a point of mutual agreement, even if we are approaching it from completely opposite ends of the reporting spectrum.
Oh, I'm listening. How so?
Well, we both agree that defensive filing and broad de-risking represent profound analytical failures.
Yes, absolutely.
An institution simply washing its hands of a high-risk region, or conversely, a bank flooding the FIU with low-quality threshold-triggered STRs, does absolutely nothing to execute AML and CFT policy.
Right.
A true risk-based approach requires the entire industry to stop measuring success by raw submission counts. We have to start measuring analytical conversion.
I completely agree with that. The focus must be entirely on downstream utility. It's not about the fact that a bank filed, 10,000 reports this month.
Right, who cares about the volume?
It's about how many of those reports actually supported intelligence enrichment, led to dissemination to law enforcement, or resulted in investigative uptake.
Exactly.
Every missing field in an STR reduces the probability that the report survives the journey from filing to prosecution. If a bank leaves out an IP address or a trust provider fails to verify a beneficial ownership link, the entire chain breaks.
Exactly. And this points to the absolute necessity of operational integration between these two reporting sectors.
Yes.
Progress in East Africa's AML framework, particularly regarding gray list remediation for Kenya and South Sudan, it only becomes meaningful when these components reinforce one another.
They have to.
The transaction depth of the banks and the contextual depth of the DNFPPs must be fused.
It really has to be a symbiotic relationship. And, you know, there is much more to explore in the source material regarding this evolution, specifically looking ahead to how the upcoming Kenyan VASP regulations will allocate supervisory responsibilities during this critical transition period.
Oh, definitely.
We will need to watch the implementation data very closely to see how both customers and reporting entities adapt.
We will, because the next signal of risk migration is likely to appear hidden deep in that implementation data long before it ever becomes a public headline.
Well said. Data without context is just noise, but context without data is just an anecdote.
I like that.
The East African financial system needs both the relentless systemic transaction monitoring of financial institutions and the deep human-level commercial verification of DNFBs to actually execute these frameworks.
Right.
You cannot declare the system a success until both halves are working in tandem to catch the signal. We will leave it to you, the listener, to weigh the merits of which reporting perspective provides the strongest foundation for that intelligence. Thank you for joining us on The Debate.